I will try to maybe spend some time on wrapping up at the end. Maybe we can have some discussion also, but let's go to the lecture itself. So, what was the logic of the previous lectures? We first understood how to describe evolution, well, how to describe magnetic fields in the universe today and earlier times. Then we started to go through different measurement techniques, first in the present day universe. That's how it looks like for different bodies, right? So we have a general tendency that more overdense astronomical sources have stronger magnetic fields. And we sort of understand that there is a relation perhaps between fields and different objects, though, in the sense that more compact objects tend to amplify the pre-existing field. And then gradually we went through the techniques starting from cyclotron and Zeeman splitting. Then it stops working at some level. Then Faraday rotation starts working better. And then some synchrotron emission. We can try to derive magnetic field from there. And last time we understood that even those techniques, they sort of have a limit of sensitivity, but somewhere for the weakest fields, maybe in the voids of the large-scale structure, we can try still different methods. So last time we considered ultra-high energy cosmic rays and gamma ray measurement methods, right? That was based on propagation of particles. Charged particles that is sensitive to deflections by magnetic field. And then that was so if we go to the void fields, that's the representation of the field strengths as a function of overdensity. But if we stick to this slice where there is no overdensity in the voids, we think that maybe the field is sort of still keeps a memory of how it was before structure formation. Maybe it is, in a sense, stochastically homogeneous and isotropic. Then we would go back to this diagram. At the very first lecture, we told that for those homogeneous and isotropic fields, we would describe them by power spectrum. And from the power spectrum, we would derive strengths and correlation lengths as two basic integral characteristics of the power spectrum. And that's what we understand for these two basic characteristics of the fields today in the voids. So strengths and correlation lengths. And then the lower bound from gamma rays, it is, well, the conservatively at 10 to the minus 17 for the fields. There are large correlation lengths, but then it starts to improve at some point. That is what? Just checking if you retained. Why does it start to improve starting from some correlation lengths? Okay, so the point was that that gamma ray method works like this. The gamma rays of high energies, they propagate when they propagate through the intergalactic medium. They produce electron-positron pairs in interactions with low-energy photons, and then electron and positron are deflected, and they are deflected in a different way if magnetic field is coherent over the propagation distance of electron, which is well, we estimate as Coulomb time. On due to inverse Compton scattering of cosmic microwave background. So if on this Coulomb distance or if over this Coulomb distance the magnetic field is coherent, then electron is deflected always in the same way, and that's the regime when we are not sensitive to the correlation lengths. But then when the correlation lengths start to be shorter than the Coulomb distance, the electron is wiggling in every next correlation scale sort of box. It will be deflected in a different way. So the overall deflection angle accumulates more slowly. That's why we need stronger magnetic field to sort of explain observational data. A bit the same effect was with the ultra high energy cosmic rays. So there is a kink here on occasion that is a distance to the ultra high energy cosmic ray source. In our example, we took some would-be ultra high energy cosmic ray source that was a source in nearby supercluster Perseus species that is behind the local void. That was the story of the last lecture. Yeah? Okay, so one more thing about this diagram is that there is this line going through the diagram. What is this line? Yes, to the left of this line, the magnetic field are decaying. Yeah, so if we start from a magnetic field somewhere here in today's universe, it will tend to somehow drift toward this line because of turbulent decay. Yeah, so the line is called largest processed eddy, and today in the present day universe, the largest processed eddies are on this line. But in the universe in the past, this line was sliding. Well, if we go backwards in time, the line was sliding to the left. Yeah. And I represented this if you look into this model. So at every moment of time, say today, this line is like this. That's the line. But then if we go back in time, this line would be sliding to the left. Yeah. And actually, these threads here, they represent, in a sense, viable evolutionary tracks of magnetic field. So there are two slopes here. Did you mention helical, non-helical fields? Yeah. So for helical and non-helical fields. Okay, so that's where we stopped. So now, let's try to go back in time. So up to now, we spent most of the time on this last slice of the parameter space. But today, the plan will be to go back to the epoch of recombination and try to see if we have some constraint on magnetic field at this time from this time, and then maybe try to go still more back in time. To the moments when the universe went through phase transitions. And then my idea will be that we can get some constraint on magnetic field from observation or non-observation of gravitational waves that would be generated by those magnetic fields. And then, as I told, I will try to leave some time to free discussion at the end. Okay, so now, let's go to this epoch when cosmic microwave background was formed. Let's try to see what happened then. So first of all, where is it? If we go back to the first lecture, that's our thermal history of the universe. We remember that the temperature is decreasing as power law of time, and when we today the temperature of photon gas is 2.7 Kelvin. Or if we express it in electron volts, it will be 2 times 10 to the minus 4 electron volt. But then if we go back in time, the temperature goes as, if we take the scale factor of the universe, the temperature goes as 1 over the scale factor. We saw this formula at the first lecture. So today, T0 is 2.7 Kelvin. But then, if we go back to, say, A equal to 10 to the, and today, A0 is 1 by convention. Yeah? That's A is the scale factor from here. D square is equal to minus DT square plus A square. Dx square. So if we put A to 1, it will be sort of Minkowski metric today. Now, let's go back to the moment when A was 10 to the minus 3. And according to this formula, the temperature would be 2.7 times 10 to the 3 Kelvin. So thousands of Kelvin. Or if we go, so T0 is 2 points, but it is also 2.4 times 10 to the minus 4 electron volt. And then if we go to reach, to the moment when the scale factor was like this, which is also 1 plus redshift minus 1, so when redshift was 1000 or so, the temperature would be 0.24 electron volt. And that's sort of high enough to start doing ionization of some atoms, right? It's not yet good for completely ionizing hydrogen, because in hydrogen the ionization energy is 13 electron volt. But, well, the universe gradually becomes plasma, right? If we go back in time before that moment. So let's try to see how it happens. Oof. Yeah, we can characterize. Well, let me try to go through the formulas gradually. So let's say in the what do we have in the universe at this epoch? So first of all, there are protons, and before the protons and electrons recombine into hydrogen atom, in the universe we have a gas of photons, gas of free protons, maybe atomic nuclei, free electrons. And well, there are also neutrinos, but we don't care about them. So now this is T, say, much larger than 1 electron volt or so. Then, when temperature drops, protons and electrons may want to combine into hydrogen. Yeah. Then, when the temperature is too high, pairwise collisions between hydrogen atoms and whatever photons or protons and electrons would just destroy hydrogen atoms, right? So they don't have right to exist at temperatures way beyond 1 electron volt. But when the temperatures drop below, the energy of collisions is not sufficient to destroy hydrogen atoms. So hydrogen atoms survive. And more or less, this all happens in thermal equilibrium. So in thermal equilibrium, all particles are distributed according to Maxwell, non-relativistic particles are distributed according to Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. If I write Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for protons, the density of protons will be NP, for electrons, and also for hydrogen atoms. For every species, I can write their densities in the same in this way. Yeah, this is the Maxwell-Boltzmann, and then we have the characteristic exponential factor here, right? So for non-relativistic particles, that's how it works. Then I want to see how many protons do I have compared, free protons and electrons do I have compared to hydrogen atoms. I want to introduce a quantity that is called ionization fraction. That will be number of free protons divided by number of baryons in general. I ignore existence of atomic nuclei. There are 25% of helium, but to simplify, I ignore that. So let's tell that I compare this to overall number of baryons, that is number of protons plus number of hydrogen atoms. So if the temperature is high, all the particles are mostly protons, right? And X would be close to one. Then, when the temperature drops much below electron volt or so, most of the particles will be hydrogen atoms. So I expect this X to evolve somehow. If I take X and I take temperature or time, let's take temperature. Then I expected the X to drop from 1 to 0 at some, say, T star, which I would tell that this is my temperature of recombination. Yeah, when the ionization fraction drops, for example, below 0.5, I will tell that recombination happened. So I can use this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution to calculate what is X. Let's try to calculate this ratio, the number density of hydrogen atoms compared to number density of protons and electrons. I can express it through X if, well, I do a bit of math. I will express it like this. And then I will substitute these expressions for every species with a bit of transformations. I will have in the exponent, I will have for protons and electrons, I will have mass of proton and mass of electron with plus, right? Because they are a denominator and the exponent was E minus something, yeah? And then for hydrogen, it was in numerator, so I will have minus mass of hydrogen here, yeah? So mass of electron is negligibly small compared to mass of proton. I can neglect it. And then at the end, in the numerator of this exponent, I have exponent of mass of proton minus mass of hydrogen over T. And the difference between the two is, yes, this is the ionization energy. It will end up here, right? Then, sorry, that should be 10 to the minus 9, not 10 to the minus 10, but so I do a bit more of transformations. I have this. Yeah, what do I do? From here to here, I put n proton to the right, and I re-express it through some number that is known. That is the total density of baryons in the universe. We somehow know it. We measure it today. Well, we don't really measure it today, but we have a good measurement of it from the process that is called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. We know that the overall the ratio between number density of protons and photons in the universe is around 10 to the minus 9. Sorry, I made a misprint here. It's between the 10 to the minus 9 and 10 to the minus 10, but it's sort of 6 times 10 to the minus 10, but rounding it, I would round it to 10 to the minus 9. So this is a measured quantity, and it's good to express it. Well, so express this relation before through this measured quantity. Then, for the number density of photons, it is the number density of particles of black body radiation. We know what is it. It is Planck distribution. If I want to calculate the number density, I integrate over Planck distribution to get some integral quantity. It is expressed like this. Never mind, zeta is some special function that comes from integration. But what is relevant is that this number density scales as temperature to the 3, right? The energy density of photons scales as temperature to the 4. The number density scales as temperature to the 3. Okay, so with a bit more of transformations, I converge to this equation. This is some implicit equation on the ionization fraction. Let's look at its asymptotics. So when my temperature is very high, this is Well, this is going to infinity, so this goes to one. And no, sorry. So anyway, we can re-express this x from the equation to get to the. We will see that the solution of this equation looks like this. When the temperature is high, the scale factor is small, the ionization fraction is close to one. Then, when the scale factor gets to 10 to the minus 3, so temperature is 10 to the 10 to the 3 times the temperature today, the ionization fraction drops rapidly. Then that's what we read, what we can read from this relation if we resolve it for x. Yeah. So there is small detail about this calculation. It does not take into account some important effect related to the fact that when hydrogen atom forms, it releases energy in the form of radiation, right? So an electron settles on the atomic level. So imagine that was already mentioned in the talk in the presentation. Yeah, but well, so if this photon that is produced by recombining electron and positron, it will not disappear. The universe is a closed system. So the photon, if one atom forms, the photon from this atom would travel, and if there is another atom elsewhere, it will interact with the atom. It will be absorbed by the atom, right? So it will destroy. If one atom is formed, another will be inevitably destroyed by the photon. So somehow this hampers the whole process of reionization. There are too many photons flying around. And we need to add some details that perhaps when recombination happens, it goes like this. So when an atom recombines, it doesn't necessarily recombine into the ground level. Imagine that electron inserts itself in an excited state, then the energy of photon that is produced is smaller than energy needed for ionization of an atom. So this photon is free to go. It will not do harm to another atom. Then at the end, we need to consider some well, dynamical equations, so Boltzmann equations for the gas of protons, electrons, hydrogen atoms and photons, and solve those kinetical equations. That will be a correction to this naive calculation that was on the previous page. So instead of sharply dropping, the ionization fraction will drop more or less gradually. Okay? But, well, people do these calculations. There are standard codes to do this. Then, an observable feature of this recombination process is the radiation that we perceive today as cosmic microwave background. What happens is that before this moment, when the universe is made of protons and electrons, photons can easily scatter on free electrons through Compton scattering process. Then the rate of Compton scattering reaction will be much larger than the rate of expansion of the universe. Or in other words, the mean free path of photon before the next scattering is much shorter than the cosmological the Hubble radius at that epoch. Yeah, and this is so until all electrons disappear inside hydrogen atoms. Starting from this moment, more or less somewhere from here, this Compton scattering reaction becomes inefficient, and photon the pass or the time before the next scattering for a photon becomes longer than the age of the universe, or the mean free pass becomes larger than the size of cosmological horizon. Starting from this moment, photons go unobscured all the way to present epoch without being scattered even once. Yeah, that's the radiation that we have today. Well, the only transformation that happens to the photon is that their wavelength increases because of the overall expansion of the universe. So the temperature of photon gas keeps dropping as 1 over A. Okay, so this is the overall setup of this recombination epoch. That is more or less back in time here. It will be something like 400,000 years after the Big Bang, if I compute the timestamp of corresponding to this temperature. Now let's see what happens if there are magnetic fields present at this moment of time. So before, yeah, the magnetic fields they interact with gas of protons and electrons. They produce Lorentz force, and with this we need to modify our description of the recombination process. We need to write some perhaps way to take into account those interactions. For example, let's write the second law of Newton. That would be Euler equation in the fluid context. So this is the Euler equation for baryon fluid or baryon gas, and there will be a Lorentz force term in it. Yeah, I guess you've seen in the context of Axel's presentations. And let's try to see how well, if magnetic field is zero, we can still write this Euler equation, but the simplest solution of it would be velocity is equal to zero, right? It has a solution, velocity equal to zero. If there is magnetic field present, so it's a source for velocity field. So magnetic field starts to move plasma, and the motions are in general compressional. So plasma starts to converge and produce over densities and under densities. Let's try to see at what magnetic field strengths this becomes at what strengths magnetic field becomes dynamically important. We can try to do like this. Let's not try to solve this equation. Let's already try to see when this term is of the same order of magnitude as the term that and positron and protons with photons. It goes through Compton scattering, and if we are in the well, if we consider a small part of primordial gas that is in the volume that is shorter than the photon mean free pass, the photons they sort of produce a friction. If we try to move plasma, photons scatter off electrons and positrons, so they damp. Nabla is its derivative. If my characteristic variability scale of magnetic field is, say, L, the magnetic field is variable on the distance scale. L. So this derivative will land as L in denominator. And, well, this term as it is. So comparing the two terms, I divided the right-hand side by rho b. So rho b appears here. Why did I do this? Because I see some nice combination of b and rho. If you remember, we introduced over the was it? Yeah, at the very first lecture when we derived some notion what is equipartition magnetic field. Yeah. Well, the energy density of magnetic field is of the order of rho v square over 2 of kinetic energy of plasma. We were calling this B equipartition. And otherwise, from this equation, we can also associate some characteristic velocity scale related to the magnetic field. That would be the Alfvén velocity. So the Alfvén would be square, would be B square divided by 4 pi rho. And I, dividing by rho b, I isolated the Alfvén velocity on the left. Yeah. And I see that yeah, I see that when magnetic field is dynamically important, the plasma will be moving with velocity that I can estimate from this relation like this. This is the Alfvén velocity squared divided by alpha L. Yeah. And these motions of plasma will have some consequence, which I can see by looking at a different term in this equation. Let's try to see to compare which one? This term on the right, which is of the same order as this term, with this term on the left. This term is the pressure gradient. I just re-expressed pressure through the sound velocity. That is like this, so I changed it to density. So let's try to do the same as we did for these two terms. Let's try to compare the order of magnitude of this term and then this term. What do I see here? This term on the left, it also has the gradient. So if I do order of magnitude estimate, I will have CS square from there. Nabla becomes 1 over L, the gradient. Then rho, well, is the variable part of rho, the density that has the gradient. So it's a delta rho over this distance scale. And yeah, I have rho b in motions of plasma due to the presence of magnetic field would induce baryon gas density fluctuations that can be estimated from this relation. It is like this. So delta rho over rho is something dimensionless, and I see that it should be of the order of Alfvén velocity squared divided by sound velocity squared. And well, now if magnetic field is zero, there are no fluctuations. That would be the situation that we considered before. But if magnetic field becomes sort of so strong that Alfvén velocity gets comparable to sound velocity, then the fluctuations can be big. This happens if I express this this over this of the order of one, I would get some characteristic scale of magnetic field that is at which it becomes dynamically relevant. That is expressed through that scales with temperature somehow, right? And well, this is an order of magnitude that explains the principle that magnetic field would be dynamically important. But then again, as in the previous time, we need to solve some dynamic equations to see what happens in practice. So this presence of overdensities in baryonic fluid would, in fact, modify this setup with recombination. So it will modify this ionization fraction X. What happens is that suppose that we are in overdensity, we have more. At the beginning of recombination, we have more protons and electrons. And this means that it is easier for proton to meet electron. And well, the recombination rate goes as density square, right? The density of electrons and density of protons are the same, so we need two of them. That's why the rate goes as density square. So the recombination rate would be increased in our densities. And calculating this, so the recombination rate is increased. That means that ionization fraction is decreased. And then overall, if we average over the volume, it is the, well, in the under densities, it's the other way around. But if we average correctly over the volume, then there will be a net increase in the ionization, in the recombination rate. And well, these plots from paper that is here, cited here, they show how, what will be the deviation from this, recombination scenario without magnetic field. So what is shown here is the difference of ionization fraction in the presence of magnetic field compared to the ionization fraction without magnetic field. That's well, the relative divided by the ionization fraction itself. So it is sort of maybe 20% or 30% in this magnetic field that has the commoving strengths like this. So we see that overall the result will be, in the standard scenario, the recombination moment when the ionization fraction was 0.5 is somewhere here. But we see that in the presence of magnetic field, the ionization fraction is already lower at this moment of time. This means that formally the moment of recombination is shifting back in time. So, is this observable? Let's try to see. The observable entity that we have from that epoch is cosmic microwave background. How would this affect cosmic microwave background? Our observations of cosmic microwave background are like this. We see, well, we have already seen maps like this from Planck several times, right? One map was dust polarization, polarized dust emission map. Another map was synchrotron radiation. All those maps are foregrounds for the interesting signal, that is the signal of cosmic microwave background. If we clean those foregrounds, we model them out one way or the other, we end up with the sky map that looks like this. It is sort of, it has no features except for fluctuations at very small level. And to characterize those fluctuations, people do Fourier transform or expand over spherical harmonics and look at the power in different spherical harmonics. And that will be the angular power spectrum of cosmic microwave background. It has a clear excess of power at one specific angular scale, about 1 degree. This excess of power is usually explained in the following way. So let's consider the epoch before recombination when photons are coupled to electrons through Compton scattering. They form a sort of fluid or gas. And of course, in the first approximation, this gas is homogeneous, but there would be always small fluctuations of density. In the form of we can represent them as waves, and those would be sort of like sound waves that travel with the speed of sound. And just before recombination, well, the speed of sound is determined. Well, the speed of sound is like this: CS squared is p over rho. And for the photon gas, p, no, so p is w times rho. So it is sort of w here, which for the photon gas is 1/3, right? So the speed of sound is 1 over square root of 3 of the speed of light. And we can imagine that the largest perturbations, largest wavelength sound waves that can exist in the universe just before recombination, they have one wavelength over the sort of the distance to which the sound can go in Hubble time. So there is a characteristic scale imprinted on the cosmic microwave background is like this. This is Hubble time times the speed of sound. This is called sound horizon. Now, at the moment when photons stopped interacting, say there were perturbations with wavelengths like this, and then we are looking at those perturbations from our point of view. So these perturbations of the size of the order of sound horizon would have certain angular scale from our point of view. And this would be the angular scale of about 1 degree. It is related to the sound horizon. Now let's try to see what would the presence of magnetic field do to this observable feature of cosmic microwave background. Oops, sorry. Yeah, so we understand that recombination goes more efficiently in the presence of magnetic field. So this means that it happens earlier. And if I look at this formula, if it happens earlier, the sound horizon will be shorter, yeah, smaller size. So this means that from our point of view, smaller sound horizon would mean smaller angular scale. We would expect that this peak of CMB would move to the left, right? To smaller angular scales. Perhaps if this effect is not observed, we can extract a constraint on magnetic field from this fact. Yeah. Let's try to see. Now, yeah, let me mix a different subject here. Yeah, well, so what we can do, what people usually do, we're in deriving all cosmological parameters of our standard model of cosmology that is called Lambda CDM. They do a multi sort of parameter fit of observational data fitting the power spectrum of cosmic microwave background. And maybe other types of cosmological data, also including, well, including measurements in the present day universe. And then magnetic field will be just one more parameter to fit, right? So we can try to do this. But before doing this, let me mention that at the moment, in this global fit to cosmological data, there is sort of a known serious problem that goes under the name of Hubble tension. If we try to estimate the current expansion rate of the universe from the data in the present day universe, like supernova data, we can get an expansion rate that will be around this, so 70 plus kilometer per second per megaparsec. But if we try to extract the expansion rate of the universe from CMB data, we will get some value that is lower, so lower than 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And the tension between the two groups of measurements is now above 5 sigma. Now, let's try to see how it works. Well, qualitatively, what's the difference of the we observe? Well, it's the same measurement as Hubble was doing when he discovered, or well, the Hubble law. We try to see what is the scaling between the velocity of galaxies around us as a function of their distance. For the distance, we use the quantity that is called luminosity distance. That's one example of the plot. So this is the redshift that is measured of the velocity. This is the luminosity distance. So close to us, it scales linearly because it goes like this. So it is The Hubble parameter is just the proportionality coefficient between the luminosity distance and the redshift. So in this measurement, people think that, the method is sort of straightforward. The only subtlety of the method is that we use this luminosity distance. It is derived like this. We assume that there is a population of sources for which we know the luminosity. They are called standard candles. And if we know the luminosity, we measure the flux of the source, which is the luminosity divided by 4 pi distance square. And by definition, if we derive d from here, what is it? It is L over 4 pi f square root of it. That will be the luminosity distance. A strong assumption here is that we have found a population of sources that are standard candles, or standardizable candles. And there is an ongoing debate whether the sources that we use for these measurements are standard candles or not. We typically tend to use supernova type 1a for this. The measurement is based on this distance relation. Now, if we try to derive the measurement of expansion rate of the universe from CMB data, it works like this. I told you that we see this peak in the spectrum, in the power angular power spectrum of CMB, and we know that this should be the sound horizon at the moment of recombination. Then in the conventional settings without magnetic field, this sound horizon is calculatable. And then to understand what, so the sound horizon is something measured in centimeters, right? But we see it in degrees. How do we convert centimeters in degrees? We tell that the angular scale at which we see the sound horizon is the physical scale in centimeters divided by the distance to the sound horizon. And the distance is an integral. If I take, I take this metric, I know that the light propagates over this is the metric. Then the light propagates over ds equal to zero lines. And I know that dt is equal to a dx for the light. And then if I want to calculate the distance, I would integrate this relation, right? And that would give me the distance measurement that is integral from scale factor equal to 1 down to the moment this scale factor on occasion for recombination, it would be 10 to the minus 3, right? If I take this integral, I know how to express Hubble parameter from Friedmann equation. We have Friedmann equation that is h square equal to 8 pi g Newton over 3 times rho. Then in the present day universe, we have different contributions to the density. We have rho matter. And then observationally, we know that we have also rho dark energy. We can express them like this. This goes as some rho matter zero over a cube. And this stays constant, yeah? And for rho matter rho lambda, we usually express them like this. Rho matter is equal rho total times omega matter. And rho lambda is equal to rho total times omega lambda. So I can pull rho total out of the bracket and replace here by omega lambda and omega matter. And 1 over a is 1 plus redshift. So I can replace this by omega matter 1 plus redshift cube. And of course, I know that 8 pi g over 3 rho total today is, I can write h0, the expansion rate of the universe today, square is equal to 8 pi g over 3 rho total. So I can replace this by h0 square like this. And then substituting h from here, I get some integral that has a known form. Yeah. Okay. So what do I see? Is that well, the two measurements, the measurements in the present day universe, they look at nearby objects, and they are sensitive sort of to well, expansion of the universe close to us, right? Close to the present moment. But if I look at CMB, I'm integrating, well, to get the distance, I'm integrating from the moment of recombination up to us. So it's a different measurement, right? So maybe, well, discrepancy between the two measurements tells us something. Okay, let's have a look at what happens in the presence of magnetic field. I see that, well, you remember magnetic field would speed up recombination. So it would tend to have to shrink the sound horizon. If I look at this theta, I understand that if sound horizon shrinks, theta decreases. So at the same time, I can, if I, well, I have a measurement, right? So to respect the measurement, I would need to decrease this distance to the sound horizon. Sorry, well, distance from us to sound horizon, yeah, to have the same theta. Then if I look at this distance, dimensionally, it is 1 over h0 times some integral. So if I want to decrease d, I need to increase h. And if I go back to this plot, so the discrepancy between the measurements of h in the present day universe and in using the integral up to recombination moment, I see that in the presence of magnetic field, my measurements would tend to increase h, right? So they would tend to move these measurements closer to the measurements in the present day universe. You get the idea? Or should I repeat it? No. So, well, people tried attempt to do the global fit to the data with adding magnetic field as an extra parameter to Lambda CDM model. They ambitiously dubbed named this B Lambda CDM model. This is from that paper. And it looks like the global fit favors non-zero magnetic field for an obvious reason, right? Because it would relax partially the Hubble tension. It would re-decrease it from 5 sigma to way below 5 sigma. And well, this is the result of the fit. So the Hubble parameter estimate increases up to sort of 70 or something. And at the same time, the magnetic field, the Kormovian magnetic field expressed in, well, in Kormovian units evolved to today, would be sort of 10 to the minus 11 Gauss. That is a measurement in a sense, right? It has an error bar. This result, if the global fit includes all this data, this is. Not only supernova and CMB data, but also the data of other measurements. So the overall significance of this would be 3 sigma or so. So it's a 3 sigma estimate of magnetic field that I can translate to the to my plot of magnetic field parameter space. It should be done like this. So the strengths I have, this is somewhere close to 10 to the minus 11 Gauss, like this. And then I can also use the fact that, say, the measurement does not give explicitly the correlation lengths of magnetic field. But I can guess it. I know that at any moment of time, the magnetic field should stick to this surface that is largest processed eddy, right? At the moment of recombination, the largest processed eddy surface crossing the time slice has some, it is a line, right? So the largest processed eddy line would be somewhere here. Then in principle, the magnetic field is supposed to be here. But if you remember when I introduced this largest processed eddy idea, I told that we use Alfvén velocity as some, well, sort of characteristic velocity scale. But we are not sure if the typical velocities of with which plasma moves are Alfvén velocity. So there is this arbitrary parameter C that stays. It is known maybe within some limits, but not very precisely. That's why I add some spread over x direction for this measurement, right? So the strength is well constrained. The correlation lengths would be better constrained if we would have a better control on how magnetic field evolves, what are the sizes of the largest process eddies to expect at any cosmological time. Okay, it's a measurement, or you can interpret it also as an upper limit. If we are conservative, this is one sigma, this is two sigma. So maybe if we take this scale here, we tell that if magnetic field would be much stronger than this, it would completely destroy the global fit to cosmological data. So we better don't have magnetic field stronger than this. That would be in terms of this, so we would sort of rule out the possibility that magnetic field is of the scale of the largest process eddy, but with the strengths with it is way below this upper limit that is here, okay? It's a nice constraint. It is perhaps even shown somewhere. I can insert this as a constraint in my 3D model. Well, whatever, there will be a constraint somewhere there, yeah? So magnetic field, these lines of evolution of magnetic field, they cannot go anywhere. They need to be below my upper bound, yeah? So I cut part of possible evolutionary tracks of magnetic field with this constraint. Okay, maybe one comment. If I look, if I compare with the lecture of yesterday, I told that we have ways to measure magnetic field in the intergalactic medium with gamma ray techniques. And I was showing the sensitivity reach of generation of gamma ray telescopes that are about to be built or already start operating. That was this hatched area. And what I see here is that this estimate of magnetic field from CMB is within the sensitivity reach of gamma ray telescopes. So one way or the other, we will have a test of this evidence for magnetic field, this three sigma effect, with an independent technique on the time scale of several years. Okay. You look critical on my assessment. Good. So, oof. I did a mess here. I wanted to, yeah. Okay, so I don't know if there are questions for that part. We can discuss. No. Everything is clear. Okay, so one more technique. Yes.
Yeah, so among the techniques that are in agreement with the CMB one, do they rely also on the magnetic field?
No, this plot it completely ignores magnetic field. This say the mainstream is the Lambda CDM model. It's some very well-defined cosmological setup with some finite number of parameters, and magnetic field is not a parameter of the model. So the global fits, they try to find best fit values for the parameters, right? Every experiment tries to find constrain those parameters of lambda CDM. So the technique that agrees with CMB, it's called here it is sort of BOSS. It's some technique. It's an instrument. It's a survey done with Sloan Digital Sky Survey that looks for an effect that is called baryon acoustic oscillations. It's sort of the same effect as I was discussing with CMB. So the density, the fluctuations of CMB are sensitive to the size of the sound horizon. But the overall fluctuations of density are also sensitive to the size of the sound horizon. And we can see these fluctuations in the distribution of galaxies, right? We also can see some excess of power in the distribution of galaxies on the sky. But that is sort of the effect is similar to the effect from CMB, and the measurement of Hubble parameter from that effect agrees with CMB. Okay. So let's try something completely different. Let's try to go way back in the history of the universe, and let's try to look at some epochs where phase transitions happened in the universe. Or maybe, that will be my reference point. But I want to discuss a completely different effect like this. So, magnetic field is something that has stress energy tensor that is variable in space. When we have stress energy tensor that is variable in space, it would excite gravitational waves. If we take a gravitational wave equation from the course of general relativity, it looks like this. This is the Fourier transform of the wave equation. So the perturbations of metric of space-time, I can write. Maybe G mu is equal to this metric that is minus one a square a square a square plus some H mu nu, small perturbations. And those, what happened? So the small perturbations of the metric, we can describe them as waves from this wave equation, and the source of these waves will be the stress energy tensor of matter, and magnetic field is matter, and let's try to imagine how much gravitational waves would be produced by magnetic field with some parameters. So the stress energy tensor of magnetic field is proportional to B square. Then actually let's make a toy model out of it. Let's suppose we know that magnetic fields evolve, so the strength of magnetic field is decreasing with time. The largest stress energy tensor magnetic field has when it is just produced, right? Then it decreases and the source of gravitational waves becomes weaker. So let's schematize a situation like this. We produced magnetic field in the universe at some moment of time, then we kept the stress energy tensor for some time tau at constant level, and then we drop it to zero. That's not really what happens, but for the first model, it would be good. So this is just a wave equation. I can, and it is a forced harmonic oscillator equation by form, by design. Yeah. So this has an analytical solution. If I solve for the constant source that exists during some interval of time, I can even write this analytical solution like this. I maybe solve it with initial conditions that there were no gravitational waves before the moment when the magnetic field was produced. So then, from this analytical solution, I can find what is the amplitude of gravitational waves at the end of forcing by a magnetic field. This I will find, and then I can estimate the stress energy, the energy density of gravitational waves. It is expressed through the derivative of this metric perturbation. For the derivative, I can derive it because I have analytical solution, and then I plug it into the energy den expression for the energy density of gravitational waves. I find something, and well, it is clear that this something is proportional to b to the power 4 because the source is proportional to b square, and stress energy tensor has metric perturbation square, right? So square in square will be b to the 4. So I have b to the 4. And then I have some oscillating part. Let's consider, well, let's think a little bit about the spectrum of this gravitational wave energy density. If I take modes that have k t k tau much smaller than 1, then I can expand this sign, replace it with k tau, and then what I will see that there will be k square tau square, and I have k square in denominator, so they will go. And for long wavelength mode, I can simplify this equation, this expression. It will be something like this. It will just have b to the 4 tau square in the expression. Now, what would I take for tau? Naturally, we know that at any moment of time, magnetic field of some strengths also is associated to some characteristic distance scale that is called largest processed eddy scale. Yeah. So dimensionally, tau and largest processed eddy are the same. So, oh, maybe. All right. So here I just re-expressed it. I rearranged a little bit. Again, so b square over 8 pi is the energy density of magnetic fields. Yeah. I re-expressed this energy density in terms of the overall, as a fraction of the overall density of magnetic field. That's why I introduced omega b here. Yeah. Then, if I take this estimate of tau as the length scale divided by c, then I will get some estimate of the amplitude of excitations of energy density of gravitational waves that will scale as just this omega b square and the distance scale square. And what I see from here is, for example, let's take the magnetic field that is strongest possible, the equipartition magnetic field. In this situation, omega b is of the order of 1 by definition. Yeah. So this would be of the order of 1. Then, in the case when magnetic field is close to equipartition in radiation-dominated universe, the size of the largest processed eddy would be close to the Hubble radius. So I can replace L with the Hubble radius here. And in this case, so everything will be of the order of 1. So I would see that energy density of gravitational waves would be comparable to the overall energy density of the universe if magnetic field is strongest possible, right? So large fraction of the energy of magnetic field would go into gravitational waves. But then the magnetic field would start decaying. But the gravitational waves, once they are produced, they stay. They behave like radiation. Those are waves going with the speed of light. So if we think about, if we compare gravitational waves and photons, their density scales with the scale factor in the same way. It goes as 1 over a to the 4. So if I take the strongest possible magnetic field at the moment of production, I know that the density of gravitational energy density of gravitational waves will be comparable to the energy density of photons at that moment of time. But then, since the two evolve in the same way, at the end of evolution, it will be the same. So the ratio of the energy density of gravitational waves and photon gas is the same. And we know what is the energy density of the photon gas, is the CMB today, yeah? So if I take this most optimistic situation when there was the strongest possible magnetic field that created gravitational waves at some moment in the history of the universe, I should expect that today, everywhere around us, there are gravitational waves with the energy density that is sort of point, well, the energy density of CMB is 0.25 electron volt per centimeter cubed. That makes a small fraction of the overall density of the universe. Today, radiation is energetically not important. The omega radiation, the fraction of the overall energy density of the universe given by CMB photons, is somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 5. I should expect that today there might be also some gravitational waves with the energy density that is 10 to the mod 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 of the overall energy density of the universe. Omega gravitational wave can be as large as 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. That's the principle. Let's try to get something from it, some observable effect from it. Can we observe those gravitational waves? What was it? I did a mess with the animations. Ah, yeah, that's my. Well, let's try to go to the observational aspect. I told this, I already told. So the omega gravitational waves expected would be 10 to the minus 4 if at production my magnetic field was the strongest possible, close to equipartition. Then the wavelengths of the gravitational waves would be related to the characteristic scale at which magnetic field is variable. If magnetic field was strongest possible, its correlation length was close to the Hubble radius. So I should expect, anyway, the wavelengths of gravitational waves goes as size of the largest process studies. Just on occasion, if I convert it into the frequency, there is perhaps factor of 2, which I forgot, but it doesn't matter. Of the by order of magnitude, if my correlation length of magnetic field, co-moving correlation length, is, for example, 1 parsec at So anyway, I can convert this into frequency, right? Dividing by C or multiplying by C. Let's see if this is observable. So I expect for gravitational waves for co-moving largest process radius of 1 parsec, I would expect the waves with the frequency about 10 nanohertz. Not so compared to radio domain, it's way toward the lower frequencies, yeah. On occasion, we know how to detect those gravitational waves, and there is a technique that is called pulsar timing arrays. It works like this. So, different radio telescopes observe sets of pulsars that have good timing properties. Typically, the most stable pulsars are millisecond pulsars that have periods of pulsations around a millisecond. And then we can use those pulsars as clock standards. Yeah. Then we know that, say, it. Yeah, okay. So imagine that the pulsar emits a pulse. a pulse in that direction. It emits a pulse. It goes to us in a time that is a distance divided by the speed of light. Then imagine that it emits another pulse after one period. And the time it takes to the pulse to get to us is again distance divided by the speed of light. But this is the distance, in a sense, at a later moment in time, right? So if the distance between first pulse emission and next pulse emission changed, there will be some distortion in the time of arrival of pulsars. If the distance shrinks, the next pulse will be arriving sooner than expected. If the distance increases, the pulse will be delayed. Yeah. So imagine now that there is a gravitational wave passing through the line of sight to the pulsar. What it does, it stretches and squeezes the distance in a periodic manner. So if there is a gravitational wave passing in this direction, we should see some systematic or periodic sort of distortions of the pulse arriving times. We can try to spot those distortions. Maybe that's the principle of detection of gravitational waves with the pulsar timing arrays. There are many collaborations doing monitoring of different sets of pulsars, and well, it works in a sense, right? So maybe let's try to do a bit of math to describe how this happens. So let's take a gravitational wave. As Axel mentioned, there are plus and cross polarizations. Let's take a gravitational wave that is plus polarization. Its metric perturbation has this form, and it is a wave in Z direction. And let's consider a pulsar that goes in X direction. That's the situation that I was trying to sketch. So the light propagates along lines that have ds equal to zero. So dt is equal to this times dx. Then, if I want to calculate how much time does it take for the light to go from the pulsar to us, I need to integrate this relation. And this would work like this. So imagine the first pulse emitted at t emission 1. The second pulse is emitted at t emission 2, which is plus the period of pulsar. Yeah. So for the two pulses, I can write the integral that corresponds to the difference between the emission and reception time. And then I want to see, so the difference between emission times is delta t, is t, the period. Yeah. I want to see by how much the period, the difference is distorted at arrival. I would write this difference, and that's what I get. So I have almost the same integral. So perturbation of metric from the second pulse and from the first pulse. And then if I expand this, so this sync, I can write that this is dh over dt times t, yeah? These are close moments in time always. If I do like this, the integral becomes the integral of the full derivative. It is easily takeable. And then I can calculate this delta t. It will depend on the boundaries of integration, and it will depend on the perturbation of metric at the moment of reception of the pulse at the position of observer, minus the perturbation of metric at the moment of emission of the pulse at the position of the pulsar. Okay? So this time residuals method is sensitive to gravitational wave to metric perturbation. To understand the wave going in that direction and the pulsar in X direction. And this is interesting because usually, yeah, if we see some funny time in residuals in one pulsar, that does not tell us much because typically pulsars have time in noise. So they are known to have time in residuals. The signal is stable, but not completely. And also, it is not stable because we are, as receivers, we are moving, right? The Earth is moving around the Sun, and the pulsar is perhaps also moving. So the nature of residuals can, time in residuals can be whatever. So what people do, they try to look at many pulsars and to see if there is some coherence in the time in residuals of different pulsars. That's why we generalize this formula for any pulsar and any wave direction. And then we can also ask, okay, so maybe if there is some specific source in some direction, then of course the all different pulsars will somehow have time in residuals that are correlated between them. But imagine that we don't have a specific source, we have just gravitational wave going in whatever possible directions. So it looks like it's hopeless to try to detect this situation when we have stochastic gravitational wave background, because now the stochasticity of gravitational waves would have a tendency to destroy the coherent pattern of pulsar time in residuals in different directions. But in fact, not completely. If we use this formula and then we imagine that the gravitational waves is a stochastic background composed of individual waves going in different directions. So n is the direction of a gravitational wave with some amplitude that depends on the direction. And then of two different polarizations with amplitudes that depend also on polarization. So we make our gravitational wave an incredibly complex fluctuating thing over the space. And then we try still to extract some statistical measure. Let's say, let's try to take a pulsar in this direction and a pulsar in that direction. And then let's try to do a time averaged of the product of their time in residuals. Yeah, that's the quantity like this. So I would need to take this integral, weighted by this quantity, and then it will give me something that is not zero. That's the result. So this is the some specific function would, that would depend only on the angular distance between the pulsars. So in fact, there is a way to spot the presence of stochastic gravitational wave background by looking at the correlation between the time in residuals of pulsars in different directions. It should scale in a predictable way with the angular separation of the pulsars. And this is a function that looks like this from 0 to 180 degrees. And it is known under this name, Hellings-Downs curve. And what these pulsar timing arrays are trying to do, they try to build this function from observational data with some success. That's how far did they go up to now. So you see, this is a measurement from one of those pulsar timing arrays called NanoGraph. The claim is that in these measurements, there is already 3 sigma inconsistency with something that is completely independent on the difference of directions of the pulsars. So this is taken as an evidence for existence of stochastic gravitational wave background. Okay. Now we have an evidence, we can guess what is the signal. So usually the signal is characterized like the in the following in this way. Of course, when it is stochastic gravitational wave background, this function here, this function h is a function of frequency. So if we take h square, we can we can construct the power spectrum of the background as a function of frequency. And in the simplest assumption, we usually assume that it's a power law that has a normalization and slope. Yeah. And people derive measurements of the normalization of the power law and of the slope. Or maybe I have this expressed in the next page, I guess. Yes. So this amplitude as a function of frequency is assumed to be a power law like this. And from the data, we can derive constraints on A and alpha. The only point is that in this plot, it's not alpha that is shown, but it's some other quantity that is related to alpha, like this, 3 minus 2 alpha. This is because the slope is quoted for the power spectrum of frequency power spectrum of the gravitational wave signal. Okay, so there is a measurement. And let's try to relate this measurement to the story of magnetic fields. So this is gravitational wave background with frequencies in the nanohertz frequency range. That would correspond to gravitational waves excited by magnetic fields with commoving correlation lengths of around parsec. On occasion, parsec is the scale of cosmological horizon at QCD phase transition, the commoving scale. So it is not impossible that this gravitational wave background is produced by magnetic fields at the moment of QCD phase transition. Let's try to infer the field parameters from it. So if I well, this page is just the system of notations used by those pulsar timing array experiments. So we can re-express this power spectrum of gravitational waves in terms of the fraction of energy in gravitational waves, in terms of omega gravitational waves, right? As a fraction of the total energy of the energy density of the universe, yeah? So the math would work like this. This is the expression. And I can translate this measurement into an estimate that the energy density of gravitational wave background is something like 10 to the minus 7. Remember, the maximal possible from the early universe would be comparable to the energy density of radiation. That is something times 10 to the minus 5. 10 to the minus 7 is 1% of that. It's not crazy. And well, according to the formula, yeah, where is it? So the formula is like this. The energy density scales as force power of magnetic field strengths. So if my magnetic field would be close to equipartition, the energy density of gravitational wave background would be comparable to the radiation energy density. But if I want to decrease it by two orders of magnitude, make it 1% of the radiation energy density, I just need to assume that magnetic field was a good fraction of the equipartition magnetic field at this moment of time. So I have a measure, an estimate of the strengths and correlation lengths of magnetic field if I adopt this interpretation of gravitational wave background as coming from early universe. And it will be a point on this diagram, a point over there. And this would be the time slice of that parameter space that is back in time, right? It's not in, translated into the present day universe. It would be something like this. It will be this time slice here because my correlation length is about 1 parsec. That is the horizon scale at QCD phase transition. So I know that I need to be at 100 MeV temperature tick in this z-axis in this parameter space. So in this slice, the largest process steadies are here. This plane intersects with this time slice over this line somewhere here. And I find that the magnetic field is almost the strongest possible, and its correlation length is almost the strongest to the largest possible. I'm wrapping up actually. So maybe relating different stories. Now I am tempted to have a scenario for evolution of magnetic field. Maybe I have spotted the moment when magnetic field was produced because it left a signature, a gravitational wave background. And then I spotted it second time at the moment when a recombination happened. Magnetic field has produced an effect on cosmic microwave background. So maybe there is an evolution track relating the two. And in fact, if we think a little bit in the context of evolutionary, of what we know about evolution, it is possible, and it would be the field that is with zero net helicity, so non-helical field could evolve like this. So this scenario is viable scenario of evolution of magnetic fields. And then, as a matter of fact, now we can trace this magnetic field from the moment of recombination to present universe, and it should leave a relic field that is close to 10 to the minus 11 Gauss with these parameters. It is detectable with gamma ray techniques, right? So maybe in the near future we can have three points where we have sort of ticks on the gravitational on the magnetic field evolutionary path, and that would be our scenario, right? But of course, everywhere, all the effects that I explained, they are at most evidences, right? So maybe there is some evidence for magnetic field at CMB epoch, or maybe there is an evidence at from the gravitational wave background. I didn't discuss that there are possibilities for the gravitational wave background, but this primordial origin is just one of possible models of the origin of gravitational wave background. So that's the state of art. Maybe I stop here. I didn't manage to afford for the discussion part.
For your wonderful series of five lectures, it was really very impressive, and I think we all learned a lot. So thanks, Andre, for that. Questions, please. Yes, please.
I'm not sure I understand how this is exactly an evidence for a generation of magnetic fields at QCD phase, since it's, isn't it? Because the magnetic fields need to be there to generate gravitational waves, but it doesn't mean that there couldn't have been magnetic fields before that, right? Or am I understanding this wrong?
So if magnetic, well, I didn't explain this, how they're generated, yeah? So I didn't propose you a scenario of magnetogenesis for QCD phase transition. But observationally, what I see is that at the moment of QCD phase transition, the magnetic field is close to strongest possible. So I learned from this that perhaps it was produced in this interpretation, it should have been produced there. Because if it would come from a previous cosmological epoch, for example, from electroweak phase transition, by the time of QCD phase transition, it should have already decayed somehow. Yeah, it cannot keep the strongest possible shape all the way from electroweak to QCD phase transition. So the fact if we spot some magnetic field that is close to strongest possible, that means that we are witnessing the moment of production of magnetic field. It is being forced at that moment of time.
Okay, thank you.
In that plot, it would have been the blue point would have been further to the left then, right? Because
Also, yes, if it would, I have the plot, but I didn't dare to show it. Yeah. So, of course, well, speaking about the generic setup, right? I have the CMB signature. I now made a bet on the field originates from QCD phase transition because I have this additional possibility with imprint on gravitational waves, right? But if it would originate from electroweak, the best possible scenario I can imagine, well, the strongest possible that I have from QCD at the moment of QCD would be like this. If I'm starting from electroweak, I'm obliged to start to the left from the size of horizon at electroweak phase transition. It should be somewhere there. Imagine that I start with the strongest possible again. Yeah. Then there are two possible evolutionary tracks, two classes of evolutionary track. One is for helical fields, one is for non-helical fields. For helical fields, the track go like this. They go along this line dividing the bound. It's a coincidence. It has nothing to do with lower bound from gravitational waves, but magnetic field decays as 1/√ of lambda. Yeah. So it would go along this direction. So the helical fields would evolve like this. And if it starts from there, in principle, the helical field from electroweak phase transition, if I trace it here at the moment of QCD, it can be maximum there, right? It cannot be there. It would be already way below the maximal possible value because it had time to decay, yeah? But I can imagine a situation that, say, I don't confirm this hint, but the other possibility would be that I start from electroweak phase transition. The field is partially helical, so it first starts to evolve as non-helical field. Non-helical field decays faster than helical, and it starts, after some delay, it starts to evolve as helical field, and it can well land in this CMB estimate, but, well, having originated from different epoch, right? So I use the chance, since Axel brought me to this, from electroweak epoch, we also plan to have tools to detect magnetic fields because there is another type of gravitational wave detectors that is being developed. It will be a space-based detector called LISA, and it will be sensitive at higher frequencies, not nanohertz, but perhaps millihertz or somewhat below. And on occasion, those would be gravitational waves that would be generated at electroweak phase transition, right? So in the same way as we make an estimate of magnetic field from pulsar time and array data, imagine then when LISA is operating, it is detecting stochastic gravitational wave background. We will be wondering, so of course, cosmological origin would be always one of the possibilities, yeah? And if we have a measurement, we can always derive some estimate of magnetic field hypothesizing that it was sourced by magnetic fields, yeah?
Yes, please.
For the CMB measure of the you mentioned before, I was wondering, is there a way to know from theory which could be the time of the recombination without magnetic fields to compare it to the observations of the power spectrum?
That's what we do.
Okay.
So in the lambda CDA model, the time of recombination is very well measured, right? It should have happened at redshift 1090, no, 1000 sums, around that, 1000 something, not even, well, not 1100, not 950, but 1000 something, yeah? And the timestamp at this moment is something like 300 or close to 400,000 years from the Big Bang, yeah? To compare with today, it's 14 billion years, yeah?
Okay, so if we have this prediction and we have the power spectrum, we should be able to know from the theory which is the theta we expect with this recombination.
Which is what?
The theta.
Theta. That's done the other way around,
theta,
right?
We should see if there is a difference between the predictions.
No, that's the other way around. So we measure theta, right? We don't need to guess it. It is 1 degree. The question...
Because we don't know if this theta is with or without a magnetic field, right?
Right. So the model that we are trying to fit to the data, it has perhaps 10 or tens of parameters, right? And CMB measurements constrain some part of those parameters. Supernova measurement constrained another part of parameters and so on. So it's not that if we measure theta, we have some for sure measurement of the moment of, well, of the time stamp at the moment of recombination. No, because it depends on a bunch of parameters. And the fit is degenerate with respect to those parameters.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? We have the exercise session after the...
Let's try some exercise, yeah.
Yes, you can also use it for more discussion, of course.
Oh, we can discuss, right, so as we like.
Yes. Okay, but let's have coffee. So what time should we come back? 5 past 20, 10 past.
Yeah, 10 past.
Yeah, 10 past. All right. Thanks again.